Guards, Guards by Terry Pratchett. Part 2. It is said that the gods play games with the lives of men. But what games, and why, and the identities of the actual pawns, and what the game is and what the rules are, who knows? Best not to speculate. Thunder rolled. It rolled a 6. Now, pull back briefly from the dripping streets of Ankh-Morpork, pan across the morning mist of the disk, and focus in again on a young man heading for the city, with all the openness, sincerity, and innocence of purpose of an iceberg drifting into a major shipping lane. The young man is called Carrot. This is not because of his hair, which his father has always clipped short for reasons of hygiene. It is because of his shape. It is the kind of tapering shape a boy gets through clean living, healthy eating, and good mountain air in huge lungfuls. When he flexes his shoulder muscles, other muscles have to move out of the way first. He is also bearing a sword presented to him in mysterious circumstances. Very mysterious circumstances. Surprisingly, therefore, there is something very unexpected about this sword. It isn't magical. It hasn't got a name. When you wield it, you don't get a feeling of power, you just get blisters. You could believe it was a sword that had been used so much that it had ceased to be anything other than a quintessential sword, a long piece of metal with very sharp edges. And it hasn't got destiny written all over it. It's practically unique, in fact. Thunder rolled. The gutters of the city gurgled softly as the detritus of the night was carried along, in some cases protesting feebly. When it came to the recumbent figure of Captain Vimes, the water diverted and flowed around him in two streams. Vimes opened his eyes. There was a moment of empty peace before memory hit him like a shovel. It had been a bad day for the watch. There had been the funeral of Herbert Gaskin, for one thing. Poor old Gaskin. He had broken one of the fundamental rules of being a guard. It wasn't the sort of rule that someone like Gaskin could break twice. And so he'd been lowered into the sodden ground with the rain drumming on his coffin, and no one present to mourn him but the three surviving members of the Night Watch, the most despised group of men in the entire city. Sergeant Colon had been in tears. Poor old Gaskin. Poor old Vimes, Vimes thought. Poor old Vimes, here in the gutter. But that's where he started. Poor old Vimes, with the water swirling in under breastplate. Poor old Vimes watching rest of the gutter's contents ooze by. Probably even poor old Gaskin has got a better view now, he thought. Let's see. He'd gone off after the funeral and got drunk. No, not drunk. Another word ended with er. Drunker, that was it. Because world was all twisted up and wrong, like distorted glass. No, he came back into focus if you looked at it through the bottom of a bottle. Something else now. What was it? Oh, yes, night time. Time for duty. Not for Gaskin, though. Have to get a new fellow. New fellow coming anyway, wasn't that it? Some stick from the Hicks. Written a letter. Some tick from the Shicks. Vimes gave up and slumped back. The gutter continued to swirl. Overhead, the lighted letters fizzed and flickered in the rain. It wasn't only the fresh mountain air that had given Carrot his huge physique. Being brought up in a gold mine run by dwarfs, and working a 12-hour day hauling wagons to the surface, must have helped. He walked with a stoop. What will do that is being brought up in a gold mine run by dwarfs who thought that 5 feet was a good height for a ceiling. He'd always known he was different, more bruised for one thing. And then one day his father had come up to him, or rather come up to his waist, and told him that he was not, in fact, as he had always believed, a dwarf. It's a terrible thing to be nearly 16 and the wrong species. "We didn't like to say so before, son," said his father. "We thought you'd grow out of it, see?" "Grow out of what?" said Carrot. "Growing. But now your mother thinks, that is, we both think, it's time you went out among your own kind. I mean, it's not fair keeping you cooped up here without company of your own height." His father twiddled a loose rivet on his helmet, a sure sign that he was worried. He added. "But you're my kind," said Carrot desperately. In a manner of speaking, yes, said his father. In another manner of speaking, which is a rather more precise and accurate manner of speaking, no. It's all this genetics business, you see. So it might be a very good idea if you were to go out and see something of the world.
What, for good? Oh, no, 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 of course not. Come back and visit whenever you like, but, well, a lad your age stuck down here, it's not right. I mean, you're not a child anymore. Having to shuffle around on your knees most of the time and everything is not right.
What is my own kind, then? Said Carrot, bewildered. The old dwarf took a deep breath.
You're human, he said.
What, like Mr. Varneshi? Mr. Varneshi drove an ox cart up the mountain trails once a week to trade things for gold.
One of the big people? You're 6'6", lad. He's only 5 foot.
The dwarf twiddled the loose rivet again.
You see how it is?
Yes, but maybe I'm just tall for my height, said Carrot desperately. After all, if you can have short humans, can't you have tall dwarfs? His father patted him companionably on the back of the knees.
You've got to face facts, boy. You'd be much more at home up on the surface. It's in your blood. The roof isn't so low either. You can't keep knocking yourself out on the sky, he said to himself.
Hold on, said Carrot, his honest brow wrinkling with the effort of calculation. You're a dwarf, right? And Mam's a dwarf, so I should be a dwarf too. Fact of life. The dwarf sighed. He'd hoped to creep up on this over a period of months, maybe. Sort of break it to him gently. But there wasn't any time anymore.
Sit down, lad, he said.
Carrot sat.
The thing is, he said wretchedly, when the boy's big, honest face was little nearer his own. We found you in the woods one day, toddling about near one of the tracks. Thing is, you see, there were these carts, on fire, as you might say, and dead people too. Extremely dead people, because of bandits. It was a bad winter that winter, there were all sorts coming into the hills. So we took you in, and of course, well, it was a long winter. Like I said, and your mam got used to you, and, well, we never got round to asking Varneshi to make inquiries. That's the long and the short of it.
Carrot took this fairly calmly, mostly because he didn't understand nearly all of it. Besides, as far as he was aware, being found toddling in the woods was the normal method of childbirth. A dwarf is not considered old enough to have the technical processes explained to him until he has reached puberty. All right, Dad, he said, and leaned down so as to be level with the dwarf's ear.
But you know me and, you know, Minty Rocksmacker? She's really beautiful, Dad. Got a beard as soft as a very soft thing. We've got an understanding and...
Yes, said the dwarf coldly. I know. Her father's had a word with me.
So did her mother with your mother,
he added silently. And then she had words with me. Lots of words.
It's not like they don't like you. You're a steady lad and a fine worker. You'd make a good son-in-law. 4 good sons-in-law. That's the trouble. And she's only 60 anyway. It's not proper. It's not right.
He'd heard about children being reared by wolves. He wondered whether the leader of the pack ever had to sort out something tricky like this. Perhaps he'd have to take him into a quiet clearing somewhere and say, "Look, son, you might have wondered why you're not quite as hairy as everyone else." He'd discussed it with Varneshi. A good, solid man, Varneshi. Of course, he'd known the man's father, and his grandfather. Now he came to think about it, humans didn't seem to last long. It was probably all the effort of pumping blood up that high.
"Got a problem there, King, right enough," the old man had said, as they shared a nip of spirits on a bench outside shaft number 2.
"He's a good lad, mind you," said the King. "Sound character, honest. Not exactly brilliant, but you tell him to do something, he doesn't rest until he's done it. Obedient."
"You could chop his legs off," said Varneshi.
"It's not his legs that's going to be the problem," said the King darkly.
"Ah, yes, well, in that case you could..."
"No."
"No," agreed Varneshi thoughtfully. "Well, then what you should do is send him away for a bit. Let him mix with humans."
He sat back.
"What you've got here, King, is a duck," he said in a knowledgeable tone.
"I don't think I should tell him that. He's refusing to believe he's a human as it is."
"What I mean is,
a duck brought up amongst chickens. Well-known farmyard phenomenon. Finds it can't bloody well peck and doesn't know what swimming is. The king listened politely. Dwarfs don't go in much for agriculture. But you send him off to see other ducks, let him get his feet wet, and he won't go running around after bantams any more. And Bob's your uncle. Varneshi sat back and looked rather pleased with himself. When you spend a large part of your life underground, you develop a very literal mind. Dwarfs have no use for metaphor and simile. Rocks are hard. The darkness is dark. Start messing around with descriptions like that, and you're in big trouble, is their motto. But after 200 years of talking to humans, the king had, as it were, developed a painstaking mental toolkit, which was nearly adequate for the job of understanding them.
Surely Bjorn Strong in the Arm is my uncle, he pointed out slowly.
Same thing.
There was a pause while the king subjected this to careful analysis.
You're saying, he said, weighing each word, that we should send Carrot away to be a duck among humans because Bjorn Strong in the Arm is my uncle.
He's a fine lad. Plenty of openings for a big stout lad like him, said Varneshi.
I have heard that dwarfs go off to work in the big city, said the king uncertainly. And they send money back to their families, which is commendable and proper.
There you are, then. Get him a job in...
Varneshi sought for inspiration.
In the watch or something. My great-grandfather was in the watch, you know. Fine job for a big lad, my granddad said.
What is the watch? Said the king.
Oh, said Varneshi, with the vagueness of someone whose family for the last three generations hadn't travelled more than 20 miles. They goes about making sure people keep the laws and do what they're told.
That is a very proper concern, said the king, who, since he was usually the one doing the telling, had very solid views about people doing as they were told.
Of course they don't take just anyone, said Varneshi, dredging the depths of his recollection.
I should think not, for such an important task. I shall write to their king.
I don't think they have a king there, said Varneshi. Just some man who tells them what to do.
The king of the dwarfs took this calmly. This seemed to be about 90% of the definition of kingship as far as he was concerned. Carrot took the news without fuss, just as he took instructions about reopening shaft number 4 or cutting timber for shoring props. All dwarfs are by nature dutiful, serious, literate, obedient and thoughtful people, whose only minor failing is a tendency after one drink to rush at enemies screaming "Ah!" and axing their legs off at the knee. Carrot saw no reason to be any different. He would go to this city, whatever that was, and have a man made of him. They took only the finest, Varneshi had said. A watchman had to be skilled fighter and clean in thought, word and deed. From the depths of his ancestral anecdotage, the old man had dragged tales of moonlight chases across rooftops, and tremendous battles with miscreants which, of course, his great-granddad had won despite being heavily outnumbered. Carrot had to admit, it sounded better than mining. After some thought, the king wrote to the ruler of Ankh Morpork, respectfully asking if Carrot could be considered for a place among the city's finest. Letters rarely got written in that mine. Work stopped, and the whole clan had sat around in respectful silence as his pen skittered across the parchment. His aunt had been sent up to Varneshi's to beg his pardon, but could he see his way clear to sparing a smidgen of wax? His sister had been sent down to the village to ask Mistress Garlic, the witch, how you stopped spelling recommendation. Months had gone by. And then there'd been the reply. It was fairly grubby, since mail in Ramtops was generally handed to whoever was going in more or less the right direction, and it was also fairly short. It said boldly that his application was accepted, and would he present himself for duty immediately.
Just like that, he said. I thought there'd be tests and things, to see if I was suitable.
You're my son, said the king. I told them that. See, stands to reason you'll be suitable. Probably officer material.
He pulled a sack from under his chair, rummaged around it, and presented Carrot with a length of metal more a sword than a saw, but only just.
This might rightly belong to you, he said. When we found the carts, this was the only thing left. The bandits, you see. Just between you and me, he beckoned Carrot closer, we had a witch look at it, in case it was magic, but it isn't. Quite the most unmagical sword she'd ever seen, she said. They normally have a bit, see, on account of it being like magnetism, I suppose. Got quite quite a nice balance, though.
He handed it over. He rummaged around some more. And then there's this. He held up a shirt. It'll protect you. Carrot fingered it carefully. It was made from the wool of the ram-top sheep, which had all the warmth and softness of a hog bristle. It was one of the legendary woolly dwarf vests, the kind of vest that needs hinges.
Protect me from what? He said.
Colds and so on, said the king. Your mother says you've got to wear it, and, that reminds me. Mr. Varnashi says he'd like you to drop by on the way down the mountain. He's got something for you.
His father and mother had waved him out of sight. Minty didn't. Funny, that. She seemed to have been avoiding him lately. He'd taken the sword slung on his back, sandwiches and clean underwear in his pack, and the world, more or less, at his feet. In his pocket was the famous letter from the patrician, the man who ruled the great fine city of Ankh-Morpork. At least, that's how his mother had referred to it. It certainly had an important-looking crest at the top, but the signature was something like Lupin Squiggle Seki P.P. Still, if it wasn't exactly signed by the patrician, then it had certainly been written by someone who worked for him. Or in the same building. Probably the patrician had at least known about the letter, in general terms. Not this letter, perhaps, but probably he knew about the existence of letters in general. Carrot walked steadfastly down the mountain paths, disturbing clouds of bumblebees. After a while, he unsheathed the sword and made experimental stabs at the felonious tree stumps and unlawful assemblies of stinging nettles. Varneshi was sitting outside his hut, threading dried mushrooms on a string.
"Hello, Carrot," he said, leading the way inside. "Looking forward to the city."
Carrot gave this due consideration. "No," he said.
"Having second thoughts, are you?"
"No, I was just walking along," said Carrot honestly. "I wasn't thinking about anything much."
"Your dad gave you the sword, did he?"
said Varneshi, rummaging on a fetid shelf.
"Yes, and a woolly vest to protect me against chills." "Ah, yes, it can be very damp down there, so I've heard. Protection. Very important."
He turned around and added dramatically, "This belonged to my great-grandfather." It was a strange, vaguely hemispherical device, surrounded by straps.
"Is that some sort of sling?" said Carrot, after examining it in polite silence.
Varneshi told him what it was.
"Codpiece, like in fish," said Carrot, mystified. "No, it's for the fighting," mumbled Varneshi. "You should wear it all the time. Protect your vitals, like."
Carrot tried it on.
"It's a bit small, Mr. Varneshi." "That's because you don't wear it on your head, you see."
Varneshi explained some more, to Carrot's mounting bewilderment and subsequently horror.
"My great-granddad used to say," Varneshi finished, "that but for this, I wouldn't be here today."
"What did he mean by that?"
Varneshi's mouth opened and shut a few times. "I've no idea," he said spinelessly.
Anyway, the shameful thing was now at the very bottom of Carrot's pack. Dwarfs didn't have much truck with things like that. The ghastly preventative represented a glimpse into a world as alien as the backside of the moon. There had been another gift from Mr. Varneshi. It was a small but very thick book, bound up in leather, that had become like wood over the years. It was called The Laws and Ordinances of the Cities of Ankh and Morpork.
"This belonged to my great-granddad as well," he said. "This is what the watch has to know. You have to know all the laws," he said virtuously, "to be a good officer."
Perhaps Varneshi should have recalled that, in the whole of Carrot's life, no one had ever really lied to him or given him an instruction that he wasn't meant to take quite literally. Carrot solemnly took the book. It would never have occurred to him, if he was going to be an officer of the watch, to be less than a good one. It was a 500-mile journey and surprisingly quite uneventful. People who are rather more than 6 feet tall and nearly as broad across the shoulders often have uneventful journeys. People jump out at them from behind rocks and then say things like, "Oh, sorry, I thought you were someone else." He'd spent most of the journey reading, and now Ankh-Morpork was before him. It was a little disappointing. He'd expected high white towers rearing over the landscape and flags. Ankh-Morpork didn't rear. Rather, it sort of skulked, clinging to the soil as if afraid someone might steal it. There were no flags. There was a guard on the gate. There was a guard on the gate. At least he was wearing chainmail, and the thing he was propped up against was a spear. He had to be a guard. Carrot saluted him and presented the letter. The man looked at it for some time.
"Hmm?"
he said eventually. "I think I've got to see Lupin Squiggle Secky PP," said Carrot.
"What's the PP for?"
the guard said suspiciously.
"Could it be pretty promptly?" said Carrot, who had wondered about this himself.
"I don't know about any Secky," said the guard. "You want Captain Vimes in the Night Watch."
"And where is he based?" said Carrot politely.
"At this time of day, I'd say the Bunch of Grapes in Easy Street," said the guard.
He looked Carrot up and down.
"Joining the watch, are you?"
"I hope to prove worthy, yes," said Carrot. The guard gave him what could loosely be called an old-fashioned look. It was practically Neolithic.
"What was it you done?" he said.
"I'm sorry," said Carrot.
"You must have done something," said the guard.
"My father wrote a letter," said Carrot proudly. "I've been volunteered."
"Bloody hellfire," said the guard.
Now it was night again, and beyond the dread portal.
"Are the wheels of torment duly spun?" said the Supreme Grand Master.
The elucidated brethren shuffled around their circle.
"Brother Watchtower?"
said the Supreme Grand Master.
"It's not my job to spin the wheels of torment," muttered Brother Watchtower. "Brother Plasterer's job spinning the wheels of torment."
"No, it bloody well isn't. It's my job to oil the axles of the Universal Lemon," said Brother Plasterer hotly. "You always say it's my job."
The Supreme Grand Master sighed in the depths of his cowl as yet another row began. From this dross, he was going to forge an age of rationality.
"Just shut up, will you?" he snapped. "We don't really need the wheels of torment tonight. Stop it, the pair of you. Now, brethren, you have all brought the items as instructed?"
There was a general murmuring.
"Place them in the circle of conjuration," said the Supreme Grand Master.
It was a sorry collection. "Bring magical things," he'd said. Only Brother Fingers had produced anything worthwhile. It looked like some sort of altar ornament. Best not to ask from where. The Supreme Grand Master stepped forward and prodded one of the other things with his toe.
"What," he said, "is this?"
"It's an amulet," muttered Brother Dunnikin. "It's very powerful. Bought it off a man. Guaranteed. Protects you against crocodile bites."
"Are you sure you can spare it?" said the Supreme Grand Master.
There was a dutiful titter from the rest of the brethren.
"Less of that, brothers," said the Grand Master, spinning around. "Bring magical things, I said. Not cheap jewellery and rubbish. Good grief, this city is lousy with magic." He reached down. "What are these things, for heaven's sake?"
"They're stones," said Brother Plasterer uncertainly.
"I can see that. Why are they magical?"
Brother Plasterer began to tremble.
"They've got holes in them, Supreme Grand Master. Everyone knows stones with holes in them are magical."
The Supreme Grand Master walked back to his place on the circle. He threw his arms up.
"Right, fine, okay," he said wearily. "If that's how we're going to do it, that is how we're going to do it. If we get a dragon 6 inches long, we all know the reason why. Won't we, Brother Plasterer?" "Brother Plasterer?" "Sorry, I didn't hear what you said, Brother Plasterer."
"I said yes, Supreme Grand Master," whispered Brother Plasterer.
"Very well, so long as that's quite understood."
The Supreme Grand Master turned and picked up the book.
"And now," he said, "if we are all truly ready..."
Brother Watchtower meekly raised his hand.
"Ready for what, Supreme Grand Master?" he said.
"For the summoning, of course. Good grief, I should have thought."
"But you haven't told us what we're supposed to do, Supreme Grand Master,"
whined Brother Watchtower. The Grand Master hesitated. This was quite true, but he wasn't going to admit it.
"Well, of course," he said. "It's obvious. You have to focus your concentration. Think hard about dragons," he translated. "All of you."
"That's all, is it?" said Brother Doorkeeper.
"Yes."
"Don't we have to chant some mystic prune or something?"
The Supreme Grand Master stared at him. Brother Doorkeeper managed to look as defiant in the face of oppression as any anonymous shadow in a black cowl could look. He hadn't joined a secret society not to chant mystic runes. He'd been looking forward to it.
"You can, if you like," said the Supreme Grand Master. "Now, I want you to..." "Yes! What is it, Brother Dunnikin?"
The little brother lowered his hand.
Don't know any mystic prunes, Grandmaster. Not to what you might call chant.
Hum! He opened the book. He'd been rather surprised to find, after pages and pages of pious ramblings, that the actual summoning itself was one short sentence. Not a chant, not a brief piece of poetry, but a mere assemblage of meaningless syllables. De Malachite said they caused interference patterns in the waves of reality. But the daft old fool was probably making it up as he went along. That was the trouble with wizards. They had to make everything look difficult. All you really needed was willpower. And the Brethren had a lot of that. Small-minded and vitriolic willpower, yes. Lousy with malignancy, maybe. But still powerful enough in its way. They'd try nothing fancy this time round. Somewhere inconspicuous. Around him, the Brethren were chanting what each man considered, according to his lights, to be something mystical. The general effect was actually quite good if you didn't listen to the words. The words. Oh, yes. He looked down and spoke them aloud. Nothing happened. He blinked. When he opened his eyes again, he was in a dark alley. His stomach was full of fire, and he was very angry. It was about to be the worst night of his life for Zebo Muti, thief third class, and it wouldn't have made him any happier to know that it was also to be the last one. The rain was keeping people indoors, and he was way behind on his quota. He was, therefore, a little less cautious than he might have otherwise been. In the night-time streets of Ankh-Morpork, caution is an absolute. There is no such thing as moderately cautious. You are either very cautious or you are dead. You might be walking around and breathing, but you're dead, just the same. He heard the muffled sounds coming from the nearby alley, slid his leather-bound cosh from his sleeve, waited until the victim was almost turning the corner, sprang out and said, "Oh, shit!" and died. It was a most unusual death. No one else had died like that for hundreds of years. The stone wall behind him glowed cherry red with heat, which gradually faded into darkness. He was the first to see the Ankh-Morpork dragon. He derived little comfort from knowing this, however, because he was dead. "Tch," he said, and his disembodied self looked down at the small heap of charcoal, which he knew with an unfamiliar sort of certainty was what he had just been disembodied from. It was a strange sensation, seeing your own mortal remains. He didn't find it as horrifying as he would have imagined if you'd asked him, say, 10 minutes ago. Finding that you are dead is mitigated by also finding that there really is a you who can find you dead. The alley opposite was empty again.
"That was really strange," said Muti.
"Extremely unusual, certainly."
"Did you see that? What was it?"
Muti looked up at the dark figure emerging from the shadows.
"Who are you, anyway?"
he asked suspiciously.
"Guess,"
said the voice. Muti peered at the hooded figure.
"Cool," he said. "I thought you didn't turn up for the likes of me."
"I turn up for everyone."
"I mean, in person, sort of thing."
"Sometimes on special occasions."
"Yeah, well," said Muti. "This is one of them, all right. I mean, it looked like a bloody dragon. What's a man to do? You don't expect to find a dragon round the corner."
"And now, if you would care to step this way,"
said Death, laying a skeletal hand on Muti's shoulder.
"Do you know, a fortune teller once told me I'd die in my bed surrounded by grieving great-grandchildren," said Muti, following the stately figure. "What do you think of that, eh?"
"I think she was wrong."
"A bloody dragon," said Muti. "Fire breathing too. Did I suffer much?"
"No, it was practically instantaneous."
"That's good. I wouldn't like to think I'd suffered much."
Muti looked around him.
"What happens now?"
he said. Behind them, the rain washed the little heap of black ash into the mud. The Supreme Grand Master opened his eyes. He was lying on his back. Brother Dunnikin was preparing to give him the kiss of life. The mere thought was enough to jerk anyone from the borders of consciousness. He sat up, trying to shed the feeling that he weighed several tons and was covered in scales.
We did it, he whispered. The dragon, it came. I felt it.
The brethren glanced at one another. We never saw nothing, said Brother Plasterer.
I might have seen something, said Brother Watchtower loyally.
No, not here,
snapped the Supreme Grand Master.
You hardly wanted to materialise here, do you? It was out there in the city, just for a few seconds,
he pointed.
Look!
The brethren turned around guiltily, expecting at any moment the hot flame of retribution. In the corner of the circle, the magic items were gently crumbling to dust. Even as they watched, Brother Dunnykin's amulet collapsed.
Sucked dry, whispered Brother Fingers. I'll be damned. $3 that amulet cost me, muttered Brother Dunnykin.
But it proves it works, said the Supreme Grand Master. Don't you see it, fools? It works. We can summon dragons.
Could be a bit expensive in magical items.
Power, growled the Supreme Grand Master, does not come cheap.
Very true, nodded Brother Watchtower. Not cheap, very true.
He looked at the little heap of exhausted magic again.
Cor, he said. We did it though, didn't we? We only went and bloody did some magic, right?
See, said Brother Fingers, I told you there was nothing to it.
You all did exceptionally well, said the Supreme Grand Master encouragingly.
Should have been $6, but he said he'd cut his own throat and sell it to me for $3.
Yeah, said Brother Watchtower. We got the hang of it all right, didn't hurt a bit. We done real magic, and didn't get it by tooth fairies from the woodwork either, Brother Plasterer, I couldn't help noticing.
The other brethren nodded. Real magic, nothing to it. Everyone had just better watch out.
Hang on, though, said Brother Plasterer. Where's this dragon gone? I mean, did we really summon it or not?
Fancy you asking a question like that, said Brother Watchtower doubtfully.
The Supreme Grand Master brushed the dust off his mystic robe.
We summoned it, he said, and it came, but only as long as the magic lasted. Then it went back. If we wanted to stay longer, we need more magic. Understand? And that is what we must get.
$3 I shan't see again in a hurry.
Shut up!